It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, scientists recently discovered stone tools that are over 3 million years old, much older than previously discovered tools. We'll find out how they're changing the way researchers think about our evolutionary timeline.
First, a political contest between two Democrats in Milwaukee appears to be brewing. In a formal announcement today, State Senator Chris Larson announced that he'll be challenging incumbent and fellow Democrat Chris Abele for the office of Milwaukee County Executive.
Abele says he welcomes the challenge, but how did we get to this point? What are the major differences between the two Democrats, and will this divide Democrats in the region?
Daniel Bice joins us now. He's a political columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he writes the Watchdog column. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for inviting me.
So it looks like we're heading for this Democratic showdown in Milwaukee. Why is Chris Larson challenging Chris Abele?
There are a number of Democrats in Milwaukee who think that Chris Abele has moved to the right, particularly on fiscal issues and on issues involving unions. And so there are, in effect, there's a new group that's been formed, and it's been formed mainly to find an opponent for Chris Abele. And so it's an interesting discussion about what is the definition of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin. And I think Chris denies that he has an interest in running for governor, but I think everything is lined up that way. You might have heard that Mike Tate, the former head of the Democratic Party, is working for Abele's campaign. So I think this is an attempt to see if he can get over a opposition from a traditional Democrat in Milwaukee County.
And now we hear that Congresswoman and fellow Democrat Gwen Moore has thrown her support behind Larson. She's been talking about how she's been disappointed in the job that Chris Abele has done. She's called him a benevolent dictator. Is
yeah,
your sense that
strong.
This is common for how Democrats in Milwaukee are perceiving the job that Abele's been doing so far?
You know, one thing that really gets under the skin of a number of Democrats is that Abele has repeatedly worked with Republicans in the legislature to get things that he wants done. And some of the stuff that he's wanted to do has meant cutting the salaries and the other perks and benefits for county board members. And you have to remember that Gwen Moore's son is a member of the county board. So there's something that hits close to home. Most of her complaints have to do, however, with the proposal to let Chris Abele help run several of the most troubled Milwaukee public schools. And that's an interesting thing because there were two Republican legislators who came up with that idea, and they went to a number of people asking if they would want to do it, and eventually Abele agreed. And I think there are Democrats who say that they should not, that the Democrats should not be helping Republicans with their ideas at this time.
Well, I mean, and then you've got Chris Abele saying, well, this is called bipartisanship, and this is what you need to break gridlock when politics are as tight as they are right now. What do you think about how that argument is going over with his fellow Democrats?
Well, Chris Abele is not a traditional Democrat. He didn't rise through the ranks. You know, he ran for office the first time in his whole life in 2011 and spent an enormous amount of money running for that seat. And then last time he didn't have any real opposition. So he hasn't gone through the same path that most other Democrats have gone through. So he doesn't have the allegiances to the unions and some of the other Democratic power brokers. And as a result, he's done some things that are different from other Democrats. The interesting thing is, you know, the path he's taken is he's very liberal on social issues, gay marriage, abortion rights, that sort of stuff. He very proudly proclaims that he's a member of Planned Parenthood, gives money to the ACLU, but it's on fiscal issues that he's been more conservative, not providing raises and other things that union members want.
We're talking to Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Daniel Bice now about State Senator Chris Larson's decision to challenge his fellow Democrat Chris Abele for the office of Milwaukee County Executive. Now, Daniel, in a recent piece, you wrote about some of the campaign promises that Chris Abele made in the lead up to his election in 2011. What did you find?
You know, when you're running for office the very first time, it's very easy to make campaign pledges, and he made a number of them, and he focused on two particular issues when he was running. He ran TV ads and had multiple mailers on these, and one was that when he got into office, he would freeze the county executive's budget, and the second thing was that he would not have county taxpayers paying for a car for him if he was elected. And I was pointing out that since he's taken office, he's broken both pledges. First, his budget has gone up 30%. 5%, and he's made requests for even beyond that amount during his time in office. And the car, he recently hired a security team that the county pays for that includes a large SUV. And if you see him around town anytime during the workday, that's what he's traveling in. Their defense is that the car was needed as a security measure. They don't deny that his budget has gone up, but they say that security costs represents a portion or a large portion of the increase. So they're saying, you know, yes, it is true that he didn't keep quite to these pledges, but there's an explanation for those things.
Right. As far as that security detail, you say this is this company that has also represented, I think, Jennifer Lawrence and other high rollers. But Chris Abele also says, you know, this is only $100,000 of this is coming from the budget, and then he's paying the rest of it out of pocket.
He had requested $400,000 originally, and then the county board said, well, why don't you do what other people do? Like Mayor Barrett has a Milwaukee police officer provide security for him. Governor Walker has a state patrol providing security for him. And they said, why don't you have the sheriff's office give you security detail? And he said, no, he didn't want that. There were negotiations, and they broke off over a couple of issues. And then he went off and hired his own own security team from Gavin DeBecker and Associates. And, you know, this is a pretty high-priced thing. The two security guards are being paid about $75 an hour. So this is pretty pricey stuff.
Now let's talk about that critique that you mentioned from Congresswoman Gwen Moore about him working with Republicans to perhaps, if the need arose, take charge of failing Milwaukee public schools. What has he said, Chris Abele, about why he made that decision?
He thought it was not a bad idea, and I think the main reason he took it is because he's been going to them and asking them to help him with some of his county reforms, as he calls them. And so when they came to him, it was hard for him to say, no, I'm not going to take this. But, you know, as I said, he didn't go through the traditional ranks like Gwen did. Gwen went through the Assembly and through the Senate. She had major battles with Republicans. She had proposals that she wanted to get through that weren't allowed to be voted on and so forth. So there's a lot of tension and friction with Republicans. And then Abele comes in and he says, well, why don't we work with them? And I think that's a large part of the reason that there's such tension there.
And Chris Larson, the challenger, has said that he would work to repeal that, right?
Yeah, he doesn't like that proposal. And, you know, actually, during this past session, there was one time where Chris Larson and Chris Abele butted heads, and that was on the Milwaukee Bucks arena deal. You might remember that Chris Abele proposed that the state would certify the debt for the county and collect the debt and so forth. And Chris Larson was part of a group of people who said we shouldn't be paying for an arena for billionaire owners and millionaire basketball players off the backs of poor people. And so in the end, they ended up removing that debt certification issue, and Chris A was quite upset about that. So this isn't something new. And besides that, Chris Larson originally was a supporter of Chris Abele back in 2011 and maybe in 2012 as well. It's only recently that he's turned on him and decided to run against him.
Now, the Democratic Party has been more splintered, it seems, in years, and they've been bested a lot in elections by Republicans. So is having a high-profile Democratic battle in Milwaukee going to negatively impact the party, do you think, or do you think this is good, draws a lot of attention to the race?
I think it's a great thing. I always prefer competitive primaries to anything else, and it's also a philosophical debate that's going on. I think many things that are going on. One, you have to see how far money will take you, because Abele's not going to be able to round up the sort of ground troops that Chris Larson will be able to, but he'll spend millions of dollars on TV ads. So there's that, plus there's also the question about the focus of the party. The party has been very, very strongly connected with labor unions, and you know that wasn't enough for them to defeat Scott Walker. It would be interesting to see if Chris Abele does run in 2018, if he would be able to get through a Democratic primary, and if he did, what sort of candidate, how he would fare up against a Republican, because on those fiscal issues, you know, he's not just worked with Republicans, he's worked with business leaders here in the community as well. And, you know, if you were to take a poll of the people at the University Club or the Wisconsin Club as to who they would prefer between Chris Larson and Chris Abele, it would be 99-1 in favor of Chris Abele. So he's built connections with the business community too. And I know there are Democrats who think this is a horrible thing, but it's an interesting discussion about where the party is going in Wisconsin.
Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure.
Daniel Bice is a political columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about State Senator Chris Larson's decision to challenge fellow Democrat Chris Abele for the office of Milwaukee County Executive. It's time for our monthly check-in on the latest science news with Gemma Tarlak. This month, we're learning about how 3-million-year-old stone tools are challenging ideas about our evolutionary timeline and more.
Gemma Tarlak is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about some of the coolest headlines in the science world. Gemma, thanks for joining us again.
Hi, great to be here. But wait, I want to hear about that marriageable men shortage. Well, that explains so much.
Stick around for 20 minutes. Maybe call in, too. Who knows?
Okay, you're on.
There's a lot of interest in that particular segment.
Yes, definitely. Well, so these tools, right? Three million-year-old stone tools. Where do we find these?
3.3 million year old. That 0.3 is super important. They're 3.3 million years old, and we found them in the Turkana Basin, which is kind of in northwestern Kenya. And one of the things I love about this story is how they were found. Basically, you had this paleoarchaeology team from Stony Brook University tooling around, you know, in their Land Rover looking for a specific site that they'd identified. They made a wrong turn. They got lost. They get out of their vehicle and, like, climb to higher ground to kind of figure out where the heck are we. And one of them said, hey, wait a minute, these rocks look kind of interesting. And that's actually how they found it.
Wow.
The rocks were the tools. It's crazy.
Well, so how do they know that these aren't just sort of weird-looking rocks? These are 3.3 million-year-old tools. Do they still look like, you know, things that would be recognizable to a trained eye?
To a trained eye, absolutely. To an electron microscope, absolutely. But, you know, to you or me, kind of looking around, no, we probably would think they were rocks. But they can tell because, you know, quite frankly, if you take a rock and hit it with another rock, it's going to chip off differently than if a rock just fell on top of it and chipped it. So they can really tell by going in there microscopically and looking at how things actually chipped off. And they were able to establish that 3.3 million year date because they were actually in layers that were partially exposed in an eroding creek bed. So kind of the creek bed was eroding vertically, if you could think about it, kind of eroding out, getting wider, and it was exposing the layers that they were able to date very precisely.
Now, I know Craftsman and Stanley say their tools last a long time, but they weren't around 3.3 million years ago. So who or what made these things?
That's the intriguing thing, because for a long time, we have thought our genus, Homo, that was the only genus capable of making tools. And the problem is, the oldest fossil we have that belongs to our genus is only 2.8 million years old. So, hey, there's about 500,000 years in there that makes the tools older than our genus. So the question is now, has the Homo genus actually been around a lot longer, like long enough to make those 3.3 million year old tools? Or was one of our predecessors, the Australopithecines, were one or more of those species able to do what, you know, we thought only us hotshot homos could do?
And so how do we answer that question?
We go looking for fossils. You know, let's hope we find more fossils and more definitive clues, and they're going to continue to look in that area. But meantime, there's another study by another team in a lab, you know, far, far away up in England, who actually figured out that it might have been possible for Australopiths to make tools. And they did it in a really interesting way. They figured out that our human hand bones have a certain density in a certain spot in response to repetitive stress, including making tools. So they found some Australopithecines have that same density in their hand bones, and they think that might mean that they were making tools as well. So it's a big question mark. It's the $60 million question. And gosh, I hope they find the answer because it's just tantalizing.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, our monthly look at some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. In your latest edition, Gemma, an interview with a woman who's helping people who live downstream from us here in Wisconsin, down in the Mississippi Delta, dealing with pollution.
Yeah.
Tell us about this.
This is such a wonderful story. This woman, her name is Wilma Subra, and she's a 70-something grandma. And, you know, when you see her in the pictures, you just have this image of her being this, like, super sweet librarian or some such. And she is super sweet, but she's a chemist and microbiologist who offers her services free to poor communities who are living in basically toxic neighborhoods. And those neighborhoods and communities have become toxic for a variety of industrial pollution reasons. She goes in, she shows them how to test the water cheaply, she helps them organize the data, and she also makes presentations speaking to folks on Capitol Hill, folks at the UN, anyone who will listen to her, and she's really an advocate for them, and it's such a fantastic story. She's done great work.
She sounds kind of like Erin Brockovich for the Mississippi Delta. So what kind of results has she had in helping people help themselves and figure out if their region has been polluted?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to even summarize the results she's gotten because she's been involved in over 800 projects. But, for example, she stopped a site from being constructed in a place called Mossville because the place was already highly polluted, highly contaminated. She helped folks who were affected by the BP oil spill, the cleanup crews. She helped educate them about you really got to wear the gloves, you really got to wear the face masks. These are carcinogens that you're dealing with. She has just done, I could list a whole book, really, of projects she's done in refinery communities that really helps people either get compensation or get relocated. And a lot of times what she does is just help people establish a link between physical symptoms and diseases that they have because of the pollution and the pollution itself. You know, industrial pollution sources have a long history of saying, no, it's coincidence that you're sick. It has nothing to do with the pollutants we're putting in your water, you know? So she really goes in and establishes, proves really that there is a link, and it's great work.
And you mentioned that she teaches people to do their own chemistry sampling, things like that. So it sounds like an intersection here between activism and citizen science.
Yeah, she... Apparently, to one of these sites, she brought around these buckets that collected air samples and helped the folks living there learn how to use. They were, you know, rigged buckets that had special filters and things, but they were very affordable. They were very easy to use. She trained them to keep diaries so that they could sort of make sure that they were collecting samples and they were experiencing physical problems. And yeah, she's a fantastic educator and advocate. It's kind of the best thing of science, you know?
And we're going to wind up with a story about a new biodegradable drone prototype out there. A lot of crazy words altogether, but it's true. How does that work?
Okay, let me just tell you how crazy this thing is. They waterproof it by adding a protein found in paper wasp saliva that makes the paper wasp nest water repellent. Okay, this is the crazy, fantastic, out-of-the-box thinking that NASA biologist Lynn Rothschild and her students are doing out in California. This is a prototype. Some parts are further along than others, but eventually they want to make this biodegradable drone that could be used in scientific research. And if it crashes, it's not going to damage the environment it crashes into, and they may even program it to crash so that, you know, they don't have to worry about creating a carbon footprint, stomping in there to pick up the drone, which is really neat. So the idea is it'll crash, it'll biodegrade, and there will be, you know, that old saying, take only photos, leave only footprints. Mm-hmm. There won't even be footprints left behind.
So I could see this being used in a remote, environmentally sensitive area where you don't want people, as you say, tromping in or having exhaust fumes. Is that what they're envisioning this to be used for primarily?
Yeah, absolutely. They're hoping to. And in fact, it was inspired because she was involved in a project in Alaska where they were studying salmon in kind of a, you know, remote protected area. And the drone crashed, and fortunately they were able to recover it without the fuel tank rupturing or anything. But just the fact that it crashed into those pristine waters made her think, wait a minute, we need to think of something better so that we can avoid contaminating the very environment that we're trying to study.
So this is a prototype. How long until this thing is more widely available?
Well, like I said, some parts are already done. They're already ready to go, but there are bits and pieces. They're looking, for example, for a fully biodegradable motor design They haven't worked all of that out, but they plan on having a bacterial fuel cell for it to provide electricity. There are a couple things that work on their own, but they have not been integrated yet into the actual working prototype. But she doesn't have a timeline for it, but I bet you in the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see it take flight.
And you mentioned that idea of wasp saliva inspiring the waterproof technology on this thing. Is this a common thing, people turning more and more toward biology, toward the natural world to inspire a human technology?
Oh, I think so. I think so, definitely. In a lot of ways, you're seeing, you know, for example, there are a lot of nanotechnologies, you know, those teeny tiny robots that function together and move like insects, for example, because they've been inspired by the way insects move and swarm. And we're seeing more and more of that. And it's, to me, it's one of the most fascinating areas of science.
Well, Gemma, it's been fascinating as always. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us every month for the stories behind the top science headlines.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Marriage rates have been declining for years in the United States, falling to record lows earlier this year.
This has a lot of people looking for the causes of declining marriage numbers, whether it's a cultural attitude change, an outcome of a changing economy, or a combination of factors.
In a new paper, our next guest set out to examine one theory behind the marriage decline, the idea that there's a lack of marriageable men in dating and the marriage market.
Isabel Sawhill joins us now. She's a senior fellow in the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution. She's co-author of the new report, Is There a Shortage of Marriageable Men? Isabel, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, let's start with the mystery that you and a lot of others are trying to solve, the declining marriage rates. How big a decline have we seen in marriage here in the U.S.?
Well, it's pretty dramatic in a relatively short period of time. A lot of people think that the big problem in the U.S. is divorce, and that used to be true, but the divorce rate has actually been declining since the 1980s. And what we're seeing is people just not marrying at all in the first place. And the result is that you've got a lot of children being born outside of marriage. 40% of all children in America are born outside of marriage. And if you talk about the youngest generation, which is women under 30, then the proportion is 50%. So it's not just that people aren't getting married, it's that they're also having children and without the benefit of marriage, and that is leading to more poverty and less mobility than we might otherwise have.
We'll get a little bit more into the consequences in a bit, but one explanation that's out there is this idea, as we mentioned, that there's a shortage of marriageable men. And reading your paper, I'm not sure that everyone out there agrees on what that means. So what do we mean when we say marriageable men?
Right. There has been a lot of discussion and writing about a shortage of marriageable men, and what is usually meant by that phrase is that men aren't doing very well economically. They don't have jobs, or even if they have jobs, they're not earning very much. And so from the woman's perspective, they don't look like great marriage material. And even from the male perspective, the men involved may not feel like they're capable of being breadwinners because of their economic problems. And people measure this in various ways by looking at, you know, how many men are employed and what their earnings are and how that's changed over time. And it is true that if you're talking about young men, and especially less educated younger men, their employment rates have declined and their earnings have also declined after adjusting for inflation. So that creates some sense that probably that is playing a role, and how much has been a big question mark.
And you narrow it down a little more. You look at specific groups based on income and race, education levels. Before we get to how that breaks down, how much do we as Americans tend to marry people who are like ourselves when it comes to things like income or education or ethnic background?
We tend to marry people that are similar to ourselves, and that's just a fact of life that if you're well-educated, you're going to marry somebody else who's well-educated. If you're black, you're most likely to marry another African-American, and you also tend to marry somebody in your same age group. So we do look at the data broken out by those categories because those are the categories in which people normally do marry. And then we can look at, in each category, is there a shortage of so-called marriageable men? And then we have to get into how we define marriageable. I mean, we have to think about, are there marriageable women and not just are there marriageable men?
Talking to Isabel Sawhill from the Brookings Institution about her new report. She co-wrote it. It's called, Is There a Shortage of Marriageable Men? You can join this conversation, by the way, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Isabel, you broke it down by group, defined marriageable men and women as best we can. Where did we find a shortage in the U.S. for marriageable men?
We basically found a shortage amongst African Americans. There really is a shortage of men there, and I think that's related to the fact that so many of them are, so many African American males are incarcerated. Many of them die at a young age, from violence, and, then on top of that, they don't have very good job prospects. Their unemployment rates and so forth are much, much lower than, I mean, their unemployment rate is higher and their employment rate's much lower than for whites. So, we do find that there's a problem there. For whites, we don't see much of a problem except perhaps, amongst the very well educated. And the reason there might be a problem amongst the very well educated is because we have had a huge increase in female education, and not much in male education. So if you look at graduating from college, for example, 60% of all college graduates are women. Only 40% are men. So there is a shortage of well-educated men for well-educated women to marry. Now, that wouldn't make any difference if the women were willing to marry down, meaning, you know, marry someone with less education than what they have. But that has been not the convention. The convention has been for men to marry down and women to marry up, to marry someone that's better educated than they are. But they're not going to be able to do that in the future. And already we're seeing some shortage of marriageable males amongst the very well educated.
And is this playing out in marriage rates for those two groups? Are we seeing fewer marriages involving African Americans, lower marriage rates, I should say, and the same with those more highly educated women?
Well, that's a really interesting question because you would think that that would lead to seeing less marriage in both of the groups I mentioned, the African-Americans and the well-educated, and you do see less marriage amongst the African-American group, but you see actually very high rates of marriage, at least relatively speaking, amongst the very well-educated, and that gets us to the fact that there are other things going on here besides marriageability. Or better ways of defining it. I mean, we don't just marry someone because they happen to be high earners or economically successful. We marry them for other reasons. And furthermore, there has been much more of a trend amongst the very well-educated towards what I'd call shared marriages, marriages in which both spouses work, but in which they also both contribute to child care and household work and other things. In the less educated groups, the men have not adjusted to the fact that their wives are working, and they're still expecting their wives to do it all. I'm making generalizations here to be sure, but there is definite evidence that amongst the less educated groups, men are not becoming more flexible about who does what, whereas amongst well-educated groups, they are.
Now, we've narrowed down these two groups, African-Americans, highly educated people, where there seems to be this marriageability gap and maybe fewer marriages in among the African-Americans. How about everybody else? It sounds like there isn't that gap. So are their marriage rates going down, too?
Their marriage rates are going down, and we're talking especially now about whites with less than a college degree, which is a very large group, by the way. It's the dominant group in terms of numbers here. And only about 30% of the population has a BA degree. A lot of people go to college, but they don't actually get the degree. And that group is having lots of problems. The non-college educated whites is having lots of problems. Their marriage rates have plummeted. And it's hard to say why. It can't be because there aren't enough marriageable men in that group, because there are. The data, really, our data show that there are plenty of marriageable men in that group. One thing that's happened in that group is that a lot of the women are having babies outside of marriage, and then maybe they're not so marriageable because the men in their lives don't necessarily want to marry someone who already has a child by a previous relationship, which is often the case. We've got a lot of churning of relationships in that group. So we have to put that into the equation here as well. And, you know, one of the things I would say to women in general, and especially to those without the college degree, don't have a baby before you're in a committed relationship, because once you do have a baby, it's going to be a lot harder to find someone who's willing to marry you.
Talking to Isabel Sawhill from the Brookings Institution, looking at a new paper on the decline of marriage and whether there's a shortage of marriageable men.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you see marriage as a priority in your life? Do you feel like you have or had good options for picking out a potential spouse? What does marriageable mean to you? Did you marry someone like you in terms of income, education, and race and religion? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Isabel Sawhill from the Brookings Institution. In a new report, she looks at the decline of the marriage rate in the United States and one theory behind that, a possible shortage of the number of marriageable men. Mostly, there's no shortage, according to the report, except among African Americans and people at the highest level of education.
You could join the conversation with your thoughts, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. Why do you think marriage has been on the decline? In the circles you move in, is there a shortage of marriage men or marriageable women? How do you define marriageable? If you're not married, was that a conscious choice, or did it just pan out that way so far? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Eric is on the line in Milwaukee. Eric, hi.
How are you guys doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
So I was just thinking the term marriageable is using a older kind of, you've got the job, you can support the nuclear family, the 2.5 kids or whatever. The societal shift has been such that men aren't necessarily looking for that. They can fulfill all their requirements on lower income because they're not trying to provide for a family, and they've got friends and family that fill that role. They're not necessarily looking for children, and therefore not looking for a family. So maybe not so much not marriageable as marriage holds no real allure.
Interesting. Eric, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Isabel, I mean, that's part of the question. Is this a cultural change in our expectations in our lives? Is that something we're seeing with men in particular?
I think that's a really interesting comment. And I think that there are quite a number of men, or a growing number, who, as the caller says, are not thinking in terms of an old-fashioned breadwinning role and are not looking to get married and are saying, why should I get married? Why not stay footloose and fancy-free and not take on those responsibilities? So I think this is part of the cultural change, as you said, that it's no longer a requirement that one be married as an adult. That, you know, it would be 40 years ago that if you weren't married by the time you were, let's say, 35 or so, people would have looked at you and said, something's the matter with you. And I don't think that's true anymore.
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Nicole in Green Bay. Nicole, hi.
Hi, I'd just like to add that me and my fiance has been engaged for over 5 years now, and we have a lack of income, a lack of jobs, housing, childcare, and if those weren't an issue at this time, we would have been married a long time ago.
Nicole, thank you so much for bringing that up. And Isabel, that was another thing we threw out there. Is this an economic change? Wage stagnation, a bad job market coming out of the recession. Is this in part an economic story of why people aren't getting married?
Well, I'm trying to understand what the caller said. If I heard her right, she said that she and her fiancé had been together for 5 years.
Engaged for 5 years. Yeah, engaged for 5 years, but didn't feel like they had it economically together to raise a child, get child care, that sort of thing.
So they don't have any children yet?
Yet, correct.
Well, then I think that is an issue. If they are waiting until they're in a better situation before they have children, that's probably a wise thing to do. And but normally, even if you are in a relatively modest job, if there are two of you and you're both bringing home a paycheck, you should be able to afford at least one child.
All right. Well, good luck with the engagement and eventual hopeful marriage there. We'll go next to Derek in Waukesha. Derek, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Derek?
Good, good. I just think one factor that hasn't been touched on yet is that the divorce rate is so high. I think it was Bill Burr, he said that if you're going skydiving and the guy said that half the parachutes weren't going to open, you wouldn't want to go and do that. And also that the divorce laws favor the women so heavily that guys are kind of losing out on a lot of stuff. So, you know, I think guys are just seeing that, not wanting to go down that road.
Derek, thanks for the call. So Derek's saying a fear of divorce. He's citing that 1 in 2 marriages. I think you mentioned earlier, Isabel, those numbers have definitely gone down since then. But is a fear of divorce keeping people from getting married?
I think it is. I hear that quite a lot. And I think that people haven't realized that the divorce rate has come down a lot and that the divorce rate is very sensitive to whether or not the two people are well matched, and that in turn depends upon how old you are when you get married and your level of education and things of that sort, because the divorce rate is very low amongst people who are relatively mature when they get married and also relatively well educated. But no question that the fear of divorce is inhibiting some people from getting married. If you just live with someone or don't partner with anybody at all, then you've eliminated that risk. That's true.
Derek, thanks for the call. We're talking to Isabel Sawhill from the Brookings Institution about the decline of marriage in the United States, some of the reasons behind that. Isabel, before we go back to callers, at the end of your report, you say it's important that kids have stable relationships. We need to do something to help keep that family structure. And that something may not necessarily be what we now think of as marriage. What do you mean by that?
I think that if two people are very committed to each other and committed to having children and really plan to have children together, then they don't necessarily need to be married. What we see in Europe is a lot of very very stable, long-term cohabiting relationships that involve children. We don't have that in the U.S. In the U.S., we have a lot of people having children outside of marriage, sometimes when they're living together already, but those relationships break up very quickly, typically within, you know, 2-3 years, and then people go on to form other relationships, and that creates a lot of instability in children's lives, and that we know is not good for kids and rather difficult for adults as well.
Back to our
call. So one of my thoughts about all of this in terms of what we might do, because I'm not really optimistic that we're going to bring marriage rates back to what they were 30, 40 years ago, I think what we should do is create a new sense, a new mindset about having children, and people should think hard before they have a child and not have a child before they feel very capable of either supporting it themselves or partnering with someone else in a committed relationship to do so, preferably the latter, because kids do better when they have two parents and not just one.
Well, Isabel, as we wrap up, do you see a tide turning in that direction for more people to either want to be married before having children or making sure they have that longer term commitment to provide stability for children? Or are we still moving away from that?
Right now, I'm afraid we're still moving away from it, but I don't want to be too pessimistic here. I think that we're going through a cultural transition in which we're still to some extent influenced by these older attitudes that the first caller referred to, which is that, you know, marriage was just the expected thing to do. Yet we haven't gotten to a new world in which people think about what is it that I need and what is it that any children I have need, and which may be something different than these very unstable short-term relationships we're seeing now. So we need to make that transition from the old world to the new world, and we're not there yet.
Isabel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Isabel Sawhill. She's a senior fellow in the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution, and she's co-author of the new report we've been talking about. It's titled, Is There a Shortage of Marriageable Men? By the way, we have that report linked on the Central Time Facebook page. You can check it out there and share your thoughts while you're there.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, author and law professor Randall Kennedy weighs in on the debate over respectability in the modern civil rights movement and whether African-American activists need to be civil to promote rights.
Filmmaker, legendary independent filmmaker John Waters is visiting Wisconsin. He's going to give a talk on LGBT culture, and he's going to join us here on Central Time to share some of his latest thoughts.
And a guest takes us on a tour of the culinary history of Milwaukee. A lot of history to talk about there, from cheese curds and beer to potato pancakes.
Yeah, a lot of great food in that area, past and, of course, present. Maybe we'll get a taste of some of that, too. All that and a look at some of the latest news of the day. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Great news, everyone. Thanks to you, our fall pledge drive was a big success. Thank you to everyone who contributed during the membership drive.
More than 6,000 listeners pledged, including nearly 2,000 sustaining pledges. And super cool, this next statistic, we're welcoming 1,700 new members, brand new members, to Wisconsin Public Radio.
And add it all up, you donated more than $775,000 to fund the Wisconsin Public Radio programs you count on.
And since everyone who pledged has entered into the drawings for 3W trips or those Packer Skybox tickets, good luck to you.
Yeah, we can't win those, but, you know, if you need a plus one, because they're all pairs of tickets, right? So I don't. That's probably not. If you need to, if you want to smuggle me in your luggage to, I don't know.
Well, it's
the
worth
Canadian
pointing
Rockies.
Out that you are also good at carrying heavy objects and fetching refreshments.
True, I can fetch refreshments.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really good at that. Yeah, a lot of people pledge. It's kind of hard for me now to break and not start asking for money again. And you could share. No, see, it's
I'm sure everyone wants to hear more.
The trading just kicks in, and
right.
You get on a roll with it. I do it in my sleep sometimes too.
Oh, dear.
Well, anyway, thank you so much. It was a very successful pledge drive, and that was all. Thanks to you. By the way, during the drive, we heard from Clyde Stubblefield during the pledge drive here on Central Time. We'll hear him on drums now with the song Funky Drummer on Central Time.